A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going to be talking with Knox Williams from the American Suppressor Association here in just a moment or two. January 1st, the $200 transfer tax on suppressors and short-barreled firearms goes away. But the registration requirement, that which, by the way, is a registry of who paid this tax, remains in effect, at least for now. And I am still unclear how that's even going to work, but the Department of Justice continues to defend the registration requirement, even though Congress intended for that to go away too, right? It was a ruling by the Senate parliamentarian that the registration requirement could not be, the repeal of the registration requirement for these NFA items could not be included in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Again, a head scratcher given what this registry is all about. Now the DOJ is claiming, no, this is actually, this is not a crime fighting measure, as the NFA has been described since its inception, but no, it's about the Commerce Clause, presenting a theory that, according to the plaintiffs in a lawsuit challenging the registration requirements, a theory of a federal power that would allow the government to essentially mandate a registry for customers in almost virtually every business that pays any kind of occupational tax, which really would be unprecedented. So the bad news is, you know, the registration requirement is still in effect for right now. The good news is that it is being challenged in court. It is also still very much being discussed in Congress, as we talked about with Representative Andrew Clyde a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, the fact that the $200 tax disappears on January the 1st, that's not nothing, right? I mean, this is actually the first major effort to weaken the NFA since its inception back in the 1930s. And hopefully it is step one in the demise of the NFA altogether. So with that in mind, let's kick off our conversation with Knox Williams, head of the American Suppressor Association. Take a look and a listen. Knox, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Cam, it's always a pleasure, man.
All right. So the year is rapidly drawing to a close, which I still have a lot of Christmas shopping to do, so I'm not really ready for that. But I know a lot of folks may be getting a late Christmas present this year, because on January the 1st, the $200 transfer tax on suppressors and short-barrel firearms goes away as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. I imagine that there are going to be a lot of gun owners who open up a box on Christmas morning. There's a little note there saying, wait until January 1st, right? But in the build up to January 1, the ATF is taking a move that gun owners should know about, at least prospective NFA buyers should know about, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's absolutely right. So basically, at stroke of midnight on December 26th, the ATF is going to turn off the receipt of applications for Form 1s and Form 4s. So making of an NFA item and, you know, the tax paid transfer of an NFA item like a suppressor. As they get ready to switch over to the new system with the $0 tax. So this is something that, like it's really kind of a technical thing that ATF's got to do, because they will not be able to process any applications that they've received with the tax paid under the new law when it goes into effect on January 1st. You know, we put in some work. We pushed them pretty hard to try and see if we could get a forbearance to cover that gap so that there was no lag time. Forbearance basically being a forgiveness of the tax, saying, hey, for this period of time, we're not going to charge the tax. We were unsuccessful in that attempt. But, you know, at the end of the day, come January 1, when they turn the forms processing back on, it's going to be a whole new world, you know, a new world that we haven't seen in 91 years. You know, in the gun community. And like, I, for one, couldn't be more excited about that.
Absolutely. You know, I know that the original intent of Congress was to get rid of both the taxation and the registration requirement, but the Senate parliamentarian kind of screwed us on that by saying that the registration requirement, not that violated the Byrd rule to repeal that. And we'll get into that in just a minute. But as you say, this is the first time since the creation of the NFA that we have seen such a positive step for gun owners, and quite frankly, a weakening of the NFA itself, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it has stood since 1934 with the same tax, the same registration requirements. They updated it here and there, you know, in the 60s and the 80s. You know, obviously we've got the Hughes Amendment that was just a ridiculous amendment that passed in the 80s as well. So there have been some changes, none of them to the positive for the gun community. So this is really a dynamic change. It's going to save law-abiding gun owners hundreds of millions of dollars a year in taxes that they are no longer going to have to pay, which I think is fantastic. That's a dynamic win. It's not everything that we wanted, but you know, we've got the lawsuits, right? Like, we knew what we were doing when we were negotiating this as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill. We knew that if we were able to zero out the tax, that would open the door for us to challenge the constitutionality of the registration requirements of the National Firearms Act, because those registration requirements are predicated on the tax being paid. So, you know, that was all part of the political calculus going in, was, hey, we want them out of the NFA. If we can't do that, $0 tax, that still gives us a path to ultimately get these things out of the NFA in the long run.
Yeah, because even if that tax had been a dollar, heck, even if the tax had been a penny, right, a tax is still being collected. And as you say, the registry is actually a registry of who has paid this tax. So that that does beg the question, Knox. Come January the 1st, when there is no tax, when the tax is $0, there's nothing to pay, how is the registration requirement going to work?
So functionally, it's going to work identically. Everything about the process will remain the same for now. You know, we are part of a coalition with the National Rifle Association, the Second Amendment Foundation, and the Firearms Policy Coalition, challenging that law. But lawsuits take time, not, you know, months, weeks and months. It takes years for these things to move through the court. So there's likely not going to be a dynamic change in the short term, but in the medium to long term, we certainly hope and think that we've got a strong case to challenge the constitutionality and ultimately remove these items from the National Firearms Act.
Are you surprised? I mean, given again, the clear intent of Congress here, are you surprised at all that the DOJ is defending this registration requirement?
No, although I will say that I'm very surprised with the language that they've used.
Okay.
You know, the Department of Justice has got some form of a duty, and there's debate around this. You know, I certainly know my personal opinions, but as it's been explained to me, they have a duty to defend the laws. You know, so to the extent that they do that, you know, that is certainly up to their discretion. We're still waiting back on some responses in our lawsuits. I'm very interested to see how they respond to ours. But yeah, it's not exactly a surprise that they're out there defending it. Although we certainly hope that, that we can bring them around to our arguments.
Absolutely. And I mean, listen, you know, yes, generally speaking, the government does have a duty to defend its laws. There have been some notable breaks with that tradition though, right? I mean, President Obama declined to defend the Defense of Marriage Act. It was actually the House of Representatives that ended up defending that in court. So, you know, just throwing that out there to anybody in DOJ might be listening, like, that is an option that's on the table. You don't have to defend it. I'm sure there are some blue state AGs who would be happy to defend the statute. Plenty of gun control groups would be happy to defend the statute. Doesn't have to be you guys. But as you say, we'll see how these cases progress. And in the meantime, there is good news awaiting gun owners on the other side of the year. I'm curious, I mean, are there any estimates about, you talk about the hundreds of millions of dollars that gun owners are expected to save as a result of this. Do you have any educated guesses on what this might do to, I'll leave it specifically to the sale of suppressors next year. What type of increase in sales are you expecting to see, or is that ASA is expecting to see?
Man, nobody exactly knows. We've got some guesses, some educated guesses. In the past couple of years, since the transfer times really decreased and you know, you were able to purchase an NFA item much quicker to get through that process, you know, we've seen anywhere from, what, about 500,000 to 1 million suppressors being transferred. So if you figure 1 million in a year, that's $200 million right there in tax savings. What is it going to look like? I don't think anybody knows. You know, the big question is going to be, you know, how much can the industry support in terms of demand? I think that in the short term, in, you know, Q1 and maybe even into Q2, it's highly likely that you're going to see you know, fewer options on the shelves, just because as quickly as these manufacturers can make them and get them into the channels, they're probably going to be getting picked up. You know, and we could see kind of a pause on sales, or at least a decline in sales in the back half of this year, we think, in anticipation of people saying, hey, I don't want to have to pay this $200 tax, especially if you think about it on lower cost suppressors, right? Like your 22 rimfire suppressors. That suppressor might cost $300 or $400. Well, that $200 on top of that is significant as a percentage of what you're actually buying. So, you know, for people that might already have a couple, just want to wait, or new shooters that are trying to get into suppressed shooting, you know, it makes sense to wait. That's a huge amount of money that they're going to be saving. So the short answer is nobody knows, but we expect it to be significantly heightened from where it has been.
All right. Well, listen, we'll be talking again very soon, if not before the start of the new year. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you and yours. But yeah, we'll definitely be keeping our eyes on what's going on. And I'd love to touch base, you know, let's say maybe a week to 10 days after the provisions in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act take effect, so we can just, again, maybe get kind of a sense of how the rollout in these changes is going.
That'd be fantastic. Cam, yeah, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy New Year, and thank you again for having us on. This has been fantastic.
Absolutely, Knox. Thank you. Knox Williams joined us from the American Suppressor Association here on Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. My thanks to Knox for joining us on the program. Looking forward to seeing him back here again before long. And, of course, we are keeping our eyes on that case down in Federal District Court in Texas. Last round of briefings due by the government, I believe, on January 6th. So I don't expect we'll get a ruling from the judge in that case on the motions for summary judgment before then. I guess it could happen, but I don't think it's likely. But we will be watching for any developments in that lawsuit as well. All right. On to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a doozy out of Peoria, Illinois. Peoria teen to be held on murder charges in senseless fatal shooting. And the real question is, why was this teenager out to begin with? 18-year-old Cedric Kennedy, according to Circuit Judge Mark Gillis, poses a real and present threat to the safety of the community. There is no condition that can be put in place that would mitigate the threat to the public if he was released prior to the trial in the shooting death of 20-year-old Elisha Gilbert back on October 26th. So he is being held without bond. The judge said the nature and the circumstances of the crime are drastic, with Gilbert losing his life, a passenger with him injured. He said that this individual, Mr. Kennedy, also had a, quote, long juvenile and adult history of criminal offenses. Now, again, he's 18 years old. So how does an 18-year-old rack up a long juvenile and adult history of criminal offenses and still be out on the streets? It was back on October 26th, officers responded to the scene after they received a report of someone being shot. When they got there, they found Gilbert and another person in a vehicle, both with gunshot wounds. They were taken to a local hospital, but Gilbert would later succumb to his injuries. During the investigation, they discovered that Gilbert and his passenger were going to buy some weed, basically. Actually, he was going to sell somebody some weed, I guess. But when Gilbert showed up at the point of sale, a man wearing a gray sweatshirt came up to the window, fired the shots that would hit both Gilbert and the passenger. Gilbert tried to drive away, eventually crashed because of his injuries. Surveillance footage taken from a nearby business shows three individuals walking across a parking lot with the man in a gray sweatshirt holding something that was consistent with a firearm. Gun eventually recovered that matched the shell casings found at the scene. The person who had the gun saying he got it from a third party, later revealed to be somebody named Sed, as in Cedric Kennedy. Officers obtained a search warrant for Kennedy's phone. They found Kennedy wearing a gray sweatshirt and video showing him with a gun that matched the one that was found at the scene. They also found chat showing Kennedy claiming that he traded the gun to a person named Rio and saying that anybody on the chat needed to be quiet about his alleged actions. A juvenile on the chat later told investigators that Kennedy had told him that he had killed Gilbert. Kennedy was arrested on December 11th after a foot chase with police. Taken into custody, police say that he had four active warrants at the time. Four. Prosecutors noted that not only did Kennedy have access to firearms if he was released on bond, but he had a long criminal history which, quote, included juvenile cases of mob action, domestic battery, possession of a stolen vehicle, and residential burglary all this year. all this year. He's also out on pretrial release on aggravated DUI charges in the March 22nd death of Ian Harvey, a 25-year-old from East Peoria who was killed while riding his motorcycle in Peoria. So this is the second person he is accused of killing this year. He was able to bond out on that aggravated DUI charge. Maybe the active warrants that were out for him were for the mob action, domestic battery, possession of a stolen vehicle, residential burglary. I don't know. But again, how many crimes need to be committed? Or at least how many crimes you need to be accused of? How many people need to die before someone is held without bond in Illinois? Apparently the answer is two, at least in the case of Cedric Kennedy and the accusations against him. Meanwhile, Illinois lawmakers, they're not cracking down on violent criminals. No, they're going after lawful gun owners, right? You can't own this gun. You can't own that gun. I mean, I could do that for hundreds of guns. Can't own those magazines, right? Can't possess a gun in your home without obtaining a permission slip from the state police. Can't exercise your right to bear arms without undergoing 16 hours of training, including a live fire exercise. And if you live in Chicago, good luck, because there are no gun stores or ranges in the city limits where you can take that training. Meanwhile, an 18-year-old can rack up a rap sheet as long as my arm and still be out on the street, illegally armed and allegedly using that gun to murder someone in cold blood. Way to go, Illinois Democrats. All right, on to today's armed citizen story from Louisiana, where the St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Office says a neighbor shot and killed a man who was stabbing his girlfriend outside of a home in a subdivision outside of Amandaville, Louisiana. This was early Monday morning. Police got the call about shots fired. When they arrived on the scene, they found a deceased male. They found a female suffering from stab wounds, thankfully described as non-life-threatening. But that very well could have changed had it not been for the intervention of this armed citizen. According to police, the woman was being attacked by her boyfriend inside of their home. She was able to get out through a window. We don't know if she busted out that window and then was able to climb out, but somehow she got out. She is then screaming for help. And again, this is about 3 o'clock Monday morning, right? Screaming for help in the dark of night for somebody to come and save her before she stabbed again. Neighbor apparently hears what's going on, grabs their gun, goes outside, confronts the knife-wielding boyfriend, tells him to stop, doesn't immediately shoot, tells him to stop, tries to de-escalate the situation. But according to the sheriff, the man continued his assault on his girlfriend, which is when the neighbor fired a shot, striking and killing him. According to the St. Tammany Parish Sheriff, the investigation continues, but based on the information at hand, the sheriff says that this armed citizen prevented serious injury or perhaps even the loss of life. It is entirely possible that police still would have rolled up to the scene of a homicide there in Mandeville, but rather than a justified homicide, it would too have been cold-blooded murder. And a woman who is alive today would not have been, again, if it weren't for the actions of that armed neighbor. All right. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A Florida chef who saved the life of a regular after the 78-year-old stopped showing up for his daily meals. This is such a great story. This is from the New York Post, but this has been covered pretty extensively in Florida where this happened. So Charlie Hicks, he is a man of routine, I guess, at least when it comes to eating. For the last 10 years, every single day, Charlie Hicks has shown up at the Shrimp Basket for lunch and for dinner. Same thing. Cup of gumbo, light on the rice, no cracker. every day, past 10 years. Donnell Stallworth, who is a 45-year-old chef at the Shrimp Basket, told CBS News in Pensacola, "We open the doors up, Mr. Hicks is there to greet us." But back in September, Hicks didn't show up for several days. And Stallworth said, "You know, I thought something was wrong." So they called his house, and Hicks said that he was sick. So for the next couple of days, they actually brought him his gumbo, which, I mean, already is pretty outstanding, right? Hicks said, "Just leave it at the door. I don't want to get anybody else sick. Third day, though, when they called to say, "Hey, we're on our way with your lunch and dinner," the phone went straight to voicemail. Stallworth said he was extremely concerned. He actually left in the middle of his shift, drove over to Hicks' apartment, knocked on the door. There wasn't any answer. He said, "Right when I was going to turn, I heard something. I heard a voice like, 'Help.' And then I opened the door up, and he was lying on the ground, and I didn't know what his condition was. That was the scariest part right there," he said. Hicks had fallen. He had broken two ribs. He was severely dehydrated. But thanks to Stallworth, again, just his concern for this regular, Hicks was able to make it to the hospital, was able to recover from his injuries. And yes, the Shrimp Basket continued to bring him his gumbo while he was there in the hospital. But not only that, the staff at the Shrimp Basket actually helped Hicks find and move into a new apartment that's actually right next to the Shrimp Basket so that they can help keep an eye on him. Hicks' niece, Christina Nieper, told the Pensacola News Journal that Hicks said that Donnell had saved his life. And he said, "I'm pretty sure that Donnell and the Shrimp Basket staff saved his life. Donnell has been texting him, visiting him. Apparently they're best friends." As Hicks told CBS News, "We made a connection." Says, "We made a connection." And here is Stallworth visiting Hicks in the hospital. Stallworth says that Hicks is now back at his regular table at the Shrimp Basket. They talk every day. Says they usually start off by talking about the Andy Griffith Show, and then the conversation just goes from there. Stallworth said that having Hicks so close is, quote, the best thing going. He says he's that uncle. He's that grandfather. He's that best friend. He's all in one. So in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for that grandfather figure, that best friend, Donnell Stallworth. And again, for going the extra mile for Charlie Hicks, the entire staff of the Shrimp Basket there in the Pensacola area, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Barry and Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program. As always, I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. I'm going to have to be a little bit flexible. I'll let you know ahead of time that I'm going to be guestless tomorrow. You're going to be the one keeping me company. I've got get my washer repaired, and the service call is literally sometime between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. So I have to maintain maximum flexibility, and I couldn't commit to actually doing an interview at a particular time. So I'll be flying solo tomorrow. We'll get back to our guests on Thursday of this week, but we will have a show tomorrow. We will be letting you know what the latest news is regarding your right to keep and bear arms, getting closer to the start of legislative dates in the legislative sessions in many states. Governor Tim Walz in Minnesota is still pushing for a ban on so-called assault weapons. We talked to John Comerford from NRA Iowa yesterday about some of the onslaught of gun control bills that are headed our way in Virginia. But we can expect, you know, more gun control in Rhode Island in the wake of the shooting at Brown University. California, we're still keeping an eye on, right? I mean, Rick Travis told us that the money might not be there for a lot of new gun controls next year. But unfortunately, there are no shortage of states around the country that have no respect whatsoever for our right to keep and bear arms, and the assaults on those rights are going to continue. So we'll be taking perhaps a closer look at what is on the horizon on tomorrow's Bearing Arms Cam and Company. You have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We are keeping you apprised of all of the latest news regarding your right to keep and bear arms, including a write-up on that armed citizen story out of Louisiana. If you like what you see, I'd also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code FIGHT. You can take 60% off your membership. If you are a VIP Gold and Platinum member, you get to take part in our weekly live chats. It's every Wednesday at 1:30 p.m. Going to be doing that with Hot Air Zed Morrissey tomorrow, hopefully, unless the washer repair guy's here, in which case Ed's going to be flying solo. But we're also going to be doing an after party tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Eastern, I believe. So I'd love for you to be a part of that. Again, just to sign up to become a VIP Gold or Platinum member, use the promo code FIGHT, take 60% off. All right, we'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.